This is Karen Lyle of SalesPort Talk. Let me share with you a conversation I had recently with Sir Robin Knox Johnson. Among his many sailing accomplishments, he and Sir Peter Blake were inducted into the International Sailing Federation Hall of Fame for setting the record for the fastest circumnavigation in 1994. Sir Robin, you were the inaugural inductee to the International Sailing Hall of Fame. Tell us about that recognition experience.
It was the first time, it was called ISAF then, International Sailing Federation. That was the first time they did it, and Peter Blake and I jointly were inducted, which was fair. It was, you know, nice to be recognized, really. And it means that I've got an awful lot of people around the world in sailing that I can pick up the phone to or email and chat to. You know, we talk about loads of things, but, you know, I'm talking to people in America, Australia, New Zealand, all the rest of it. And we have an understanding. We sort of respect each other. And it's great to talk to people who I think are probably the head of the game.
After all your years of sailing on the ocean, do you ever think you know the seas and have mastered them?
All of us who go to sea, we can't afford to be arrogant. The sea will get us if we start thinking we're arrogant. The sea is always dangerous. And I think the one thing we share, those of us who cross oceans, is a respect for the sea and respect for each other who've done it. And it's a wonderful fraternity, that, and it's international. It doesn't know natural boundaries. It's something we just share between us. If you've sailed a good voyage, well, I'm interested. And, you know, you've done well to do it. And I think we have that wonderful friendship amongst ocean sailors. And long may it last.
Tell us about your Indian Ocean experience.
Yeah, I spent 5 years of my life as a commercial sailor, going from Bombay to Basra and Bombay to Mombasa. So, yeah, and I sailed across it in Suhaili, my boat, after I built her in India, sailed out to Arabia, down to Mombasa, down the coast. So, yeah, I know the Indian Ocean quite well.
As founder of the Clipper Around the World race, you've trained many amateurs to undertake difficult ocean voyages. In 2020, before the race was suspended due to the coronavirus, tell us about your sailors.
This latest race, I've got 44 nationalities. So, you know, it's become very international. But the wonderful thing about it is I look at the crews as they come in from a long voyage. And particularly if you're going from China to Seattle, that's a very tough voyage across the North Pacific. And you watch them come in. I remember one guy coming up to me and saying, "That's the toughest thing I've done in my life. But now I feel I'm a proper sailor." And I thought, well, bloody good on you. Well done, because you have achieved something special. 5,000 miles across the North Pacific this time of year. Well done. Those are the things that give me a big, big boost, frankly, watching the people change, get more confident, become better sailors. They realize they've taken on nature in the raw, and they come away saying, I've done something special in my life, and they have.
All right, the dulcet tones of Criss Cross Applesauce on a Tuesday at 9:40 can mean one thing and one thing only. It's time to talk to our friends at SalesportTalk.com. Joining to co-host this segment with me, as she's done many times before, it is Patty Mangan. How you doing, Patty?
I'm doing great, Rick. How are you?
Not too bad. And we want to make sure we bring in our guests. I wanted to say Susan Weiss, but it's Susan Wells with one L. Is that what it is, Susan?
That's correct. Susan Wells.
Susan Wells with one L. Okay, so it's not a misprint. You are the New York Times bestselling author, historian, and journalist, and we're here to talk about your book, Titanic, Legacy of the World's Greatest Ocean Liner. This was printed back in 97 from Time Life Books. And first of all, let's just get the bad part out of the way. Your thoughts about the submersible and the implosion, and because I know you've been around that part of the world.
Yeah, it was really just a terrible thing. I was also the correspondent on the 1998 Titanic expedition, and I knew P.H. Nargileh, who died aboard the Titan. Mm-hmm. And that week when the Titan went missing was one of the hardest in recent memory, just imagining PH basically suffocating to death, and all those poor people who have, you know, many of whom paid $250,000 for the right to die aboard the Titan. It was just terrible, and you know, it was an awful thing because PH Nargileh was basically the Jacques Cousteau of deep ocean submersibles. He knew everything there was to know about them. He ran the French Navy's deep ocean submersible program, and he was one of the mission commanders on my expedition and in charge of the submersible Nautile, which was run by the French Navy. So it was a horrible loss, and the Titan never should have attempted to go down to those depths. It just was not constructed well, and everybody knew it, but they wouldn't test it. So it's just a tragedy.
Yes, I think that what's so interesting for and why Susan and I reached out to you, because we go back to 1985, right, which is when they found, you and I go back to 1985, but that's when they found the Titanic. And I was thinking about why all this came together for me in terms of reaching out to you, and you had just spoken at Titanic. How do you say it?
Titanic-Con.
Titanic-Con.
In Las Vegas, yeah.
and then weeks later, I'm already thinking about you, but then the implosion happens, and then I go back and do a little research on the Titanic, and I'm like going, it's all present day for me. And then you and I are talking, and this book was published in 1997. But it brings it all in context now, in terms of in the past, for me, for the past 10 years, I've been focusing on boats and boating and history and the art of building boats and the sailing of boats and the racing of boats. And so I was curious about the Titanic and its origins. And I know you went to Belfast to go check out the shipyard.
I did. Yeah, I was actually working on a book at the time about the history of the Harland and Wolff shipyard in Belfast. And that was the shipyard that built the Titanic. And it's now pretty much defunct. In fact, they sold 185 acres of their surplus shipyard. It's now called the Titanic Quarter and has the Titanic Belfast visitor attraction. When I was there, of course, the original slipways were still there, and it was still a very small but functioning shipyard. And I was able to spend time with folks whose fathers and grandfathers had all worked in the yards, and some of whom went back to the time of the Titanic. So it was a remarkable experience.
When you see, you know, the popularity of that movie, do you think, hey, this is a great entertaining movie and a wonderful love story, or does it make you sick with historical inaccuracies?
Just the opposite, Rick, honestly. I went to see the James Cameron's movie the day it opened in San Francisco, and my book had come out just a couple of months earlier and was sitting in the bookstores, and I'd been immersed in Titanic history. I was amazed at the accuracy of Cameron's movie, that I honestly feel that it was about 95% accurate. Obviously, he created some storylines. You have to have human interest in order to sustain a film of that length, but as far as the facts about the ship and the representation of the ship, it was remarkable. And as I came out of the movie theater, I was standing outside and I could almost feel the thunder under my feet. I knew it was going to be huge. And it was.
It was great timing for the book, too. Is it true that there was a false, what do you call it, the big pipe that comes up for the exhaust, that there was actually, for aesthetics, they added another one that was actually, that wasn't used?
You know, I'm not an expert on marine architecture, so there are plenty of people who could answer that question for you, but I can't at the moment. But I can talk about the history.
So Titanic was one of three that they had planned for, building and getting out there to compete against the rivalry cruise ships going across back and forth. And did your book cover that kind of information about what happened to those other boats and what the history was with them? Did they continue on to be successful, and did the shipyards continue to be successful?
Well, the shipyard, I can tell you, was successful, certainly through World War II. Then the shipbuilding enterprise became extremely competitive with a lot of new yards built in Asia, and they gradually declined. But there were planned to be three ships, the Olympic, the Titanic, and the Gigantic, and they were supposed to be the largest moving objects ever made by man at the time. So they were quite something, and they were constructed by Harland and Wolff for the White Star Line, and Harland and Wolff built all the ships for the White Star Line. And I can tell you that the Olympic went on to serve as, I think, either a hospital ship or a troop ship during World War II. I'm not sure what happened to the Gigantic, if it was actually even ever completed, but we know what happened to the Titanic for sure.
I want to ask you about the, by the way, we're speaking with Susan Wells, the captain of the ship, Edward Smith. He went down with the ship, and a lot of people say that he was a hero for that. There's a statue in his hometown in Litchfield about what a hero he is. My question is, even though he was asleep, I guess, when this happened, and it wasn't his fault, do you consider him a hero for not jumping off, or do you think it was insane to basically sacrifice yourself because it went down on his watch?
It was expected of captains to go down with a ship. And honestly, I do fault Smith because he was speeding. He was basically speeding through an ice field.
Wow.
And the reason for that is that there was a huge competition to be the fastest transatlantic ship at the time. And starting in the late 1890s, Britain was actually competing with Germany for the world's fastest transatlantic ships. And the Cunard Line was competing on speed. The White Star Line was known for competing on luxury and comfort. But Smith and J. Bruce Ismay, the chairman of the White Star Line, part of their agenda was to have the break the speed record for the fastest transatlantic crossing in 1912. And so instead of going slowly through this ice field, Smith was just ramming ahead. And so, yeah, he was speeding, and I fault him for that for sure.
I don't know that much about these. You know, the ice that he ran into, did it move? Did it move enough that they were surprised?
Did the ice move?
The iceberg, yeah.
Well, I mean, icebergs move, and ice float, you know, growlers and all, ice fields, you know, they're moving objects because there are waves. But, you know, he didn't use enough caution. And
right.
There were warnings about ice and all of that, but he was trying to break a speed record.
And it might have been just a little too comfortable in general. I want to ask you about your latest publication, Assassin in Utopia.
My latest book is called, as you mentioned, An Assassin in Utopia, the true story of a 19th century sex cult and a president's murder. And it's the first book to tie together the 1881 assassination of President James Garfield and a utopian free love community in upstate New York, because the assassin had been a member of it for 6 years. And after 12 years of research, I got, you know, wonderful reviews on this from the New York Times and Washington Post and others. And it was just a joy to write. It's an incredibly strange story, and it's never been told before.
And it's true.
Well, I'm interested in that because I just got done with the Candace Millard book, Destiny of the Republic, which was a fascinating book on Garfield. So I like how you tie that all together there.
Yeah, I think you should probably put this on your reading list next. It's another side of the story.
What is, before we let you go, what are one or two of the nuances or just anecdotes that live in history of the Titanic that bug you because they're fake? And then on contrastly, what are some of the things you'd like people to know that didn't know about the Titanic?
Wow. Well, I think one of the controversies that's still going today is about whether artifacts should be recovered from the wreck site or whether it's a graveyard. And I believe that Robert Ballard, who has taken credit for discovering the Titanic along with the French, holds strongly to the position that it's a graveyard and that people should be able to visit it and see the artifacts in place. Well, I think we've seen what happens when you try to bring tourists down to the Titanic. It's an incredibly dangerous situation. You're 12,500 feet below the ocean and the 6,000 pounds of pressure per square inch. And what happened with the Titan, I think, is a very cautionary tale. More than 3,000 objects have been recovered. They are available to the public. They're on display. And I think those are the things that bring people close to the history. And I'm a big supporter of continuing to research the Titanic and to share that history through the objects and the stories with everybody.
Very interesting stuff from our guest, Susan Wells, New York Times bestselling author. Rick Tuttle, along with Patty Mangan for SalesportTalk.com on Sports Byline. Thank you for coming on the show, Susan.
You're welcome.
All right.
Yeah, I'd like to have you back. Thank you.